You're doing all the right things, like eating clean and staying active, but nearly all of us are still missing a key piece, minerals. Concentrace Daily Mineral Powder helps restore what your body's not getting, supporting mood, energy, immunity, and nervous system balance. It's made from ionic trace minerals your body actually absorbs and comes in three delicious flavors, blue raspberry, blue Hawaiian, and blue acai. Because your body can't make minerals and modern food and water don't supply enough, start with minerals. Start with Concentrace. Find it now at TraceMinerals.com. Feel off, tired, moody? You might be missing minerals because 99% of us are. Concentrace Daily Mineral Powder helps support energy, mood, and immunity from the inside out. Go to TraceMinerals.com and feel the difference minerals make.
Hey, pull up a chair. It's Hacks on Tap with David Axelrod and Mike Murphy.
Hey, Ax, how you doing? We got a big news week. A lot to talk about here.
Yeah, it seems like that happens every week these days and every day.
Not a dull time.
The things you talk about in the morning are not the top of the news by the evening because things are so crazy. But the big crazy story of the day, or at least one of them, and concerning one, is this whole issue of the withdrawal of troops from northern Syria. And the president, although they now deny it, apparently green-lighting Turkey on a kind of cleansing episode to get rid of the Kurds there, who've been our biggest allies there. That the substance of that has been all picked apart. But let's listen to this clip from President Trump explaining his position on this.
These ISIS people, whatever you want to call them, these people are right there. They're right there. They're touching many of these countries that I just named. Iran, as an example, hates ISIS, and ISIS hates Iran. Iraq, you know all about that. Turkey, Syria, let them take care of it. Let them take care of it. We want to bring our troops back home.
So, Murphy, I know where the foreign policy community is, the national security community. The Kurds were holding 10,000 ISIS fighters. That's a huge concern. There are a lot of reasons to be concerned about what he did. But I'm asking you a political question. It seems to me that he may be right on the politics, that what he just said is what a lot of Americans feel, which is let them take care of it. Why do we have to take care of it?
You know, that's an interesting point. I mean, first, just an observation. When you hear Trump with just audio, no picture, it's even worse. It even sounds crazier. And I like the creepy thing into touching. It's so Trump and so weird. But to your question, yeah, I think if unmolested by other sources of information people are getting, where all they hear is bring our boys home, that is a perennial working message in American politics, because we have a long strain of kind of on-again, off-again isolationist feeling, both in the Republican Party and the country as a whole. So I can kind of get that, but I don't think this will be alone. This is such a betrayal to folks who have spilled incredible blood fighting as our proxy up there. And what people are going to hear is we're going to open the gate to Putin, to the Iranians, to other people there. The entire foreign policy community is going to condemn this. And I think it was a tell even in the impeachment fight, because Republicans who've been afraid of their primary voters on this are speaking up.
Mitch almost McConnell, in unison.
Obviously, Rubio even, you know, who's not Captain Spine on most issues. So I think this thing is such a
McConnell
blunder that it's giving Republicans in the Senate, which is the center of the world right now, even more pause about this guy.
Yeah, you know, what's interesting about that is Lindsey Graham was the most outspoken about this. This is something of real concern to him, and he really rebuked Trump. Simultaneously, he announced that as chairman of the Judiciary Committee, he was going to bring Rudy Giuliani in to air some of these concerns about the Bidens and Ukraine and corruption in Ukraine. And I can imagine a call from Lindsey to the president saying, look, I'm going to have to cuff you around on this thing.
Right.
But I got your back on the one that really matters, which is this impeachment issue. But so, you know, I actually think you're going to see people be more hyper on the Republican side, more hyperbolically defensive of the president on the impeachment issue to clean up their accounts after they slap him around on this.
Yeah, there might be some of that. I mean, I think for the average Republican senator, the calculus of joining on the impeachment thing politically is, well, then I'm rooting for the New York Times, I'm in with the Democrats, the mainstream media, all the people my primary voters hate, all Trump's enemies. I'm now one of their friends. That's a political disaster for me. But on this issue, this is not siding with the Democrats. This is siding with the Kurds, who've been our most loyal ally, in a huge sellout. And the Kurds have a lot of friends in the Senate, a lot more than the Turkish kind of semi-dictator does. A lot of the senators have been there. The Kurds have been kind of a special project. So they've got a base of support, and it doesn't make it for a Republican senator an R versus D thing. So it's kind of easier to go with Trump. But we'll see.
Well,
but Trump will react, though,
and
will start attacking everybody because he's clearly in a weak state.
Other people who were upset were the Israelis, who apparently didn't get a heads up and have a big stake
in this. Yeah, nobody did. The Brits and the French were upset.
I'm just telling you, though. I am telling you, Mike Murphy, my gut tells me that this is one of those things where he has a visceral sense. He may have to pull back, and he's shown signs of pulling back because the Congress may actually repudiate him. And may reverse his decision in a rare display of bipartisanship. They did before on this issue. They could hear. But I just, when I heard him say what we heard him say, my thought was a lot of his voters are nodding their heads in agreement with him. And I think he knows that. So it'll be interesting to see how he sorts this out.
But question for you first, just before we move on.
Yeah.
I agree that Bring the Boys Home has power among his voters. But are his voters enough to win?
No, but he's never really recognized that.
Right, right. That's the
fundamental. He's never really recognized that. He is a base, always, and only person. And he thinks that this was a fundamental commitment of his. You know, to end the endless wars, and that this plays with the base. We'll see what this pounding that he's taking from his own people as well as across the aisle will do to him. But I'm telling you, I just think this is one to watch. I'll be eager to see the first polls on this because your tribute to the Kurds is very valid. I share your view on this. I don't think, to be real frank with you, that most Americans give a shit about the Kurds.
No, that's where we start. The question is, you know, in politics is always where you finish. And the Kurds have a story to tell. Now we'll find out if they tell it.
We got John Heilman coming, our buddy John Heilman. So I want to move us along because we do have to talk about the impeachment story. There are new developments. One of the things that intrigued me was just to review the thing that sort of torqued it up to another level was a thing the president said last week. And I don't want to replay the whole thing. Everybody's heard it a million times. But let's listen to this one line because it prompted some crazy stuff on the Sunday shows.
And by the way, likewise, China should start an investigation into the Bidens.
So, Murphy, you are yeah, I know.
What a joke.
I consider you a funny guy.
Yeah.
That is bad. If that was comedy, that was very bad material.
Yeah.
But
yeah, the new Republican talking point is every day is April Fool's, so don't believe anything he says, which is the bottom of the barrel of spin lines.
But that was, you know, Marco Rubio started it. He said, oh, he was kidding. He was just trying to gig the press. And that became the talking point for Roy Blunt, for Jim Jordan. Every Republican went on TV and said, oh, he was just kidding. He didn't sound like he was kidding to me. He's not that jocular.
No, he means every word of it. He's crazy. You know, we get evidence every day, and then the Republicans in their rubble have to reconstruct some insane theories. Oh, he was just joking. Yeah, he likes to drive you guys crazy. I mean, it's one of these things where they have to have something, and they've run out of anything that makes any sense, so they're going to that. Now, when he talked about the Kurds, all of a sudden, he wasn't joking. Apparently, for Marco Rubio, that was incredibly true. So, you know, it's, as I said, bottom of the barrel spin, because they have nothing else.
But I got to challenge you on this as well. You know, I just did it's going to be on Saturday night. I just spent the day yesterday with Harry Reid out in Nevada. And Harry said, you know, I used to think this guy was dumb. He said, I don't think that anymore. He said, you know, he's not dumb, and he has, you know, whether it's by instinct or intentionally, he knows where he's going. I think on this, even on this, on the China thing, you know, he decided, I'm going to double down. I got caught with my hand in the cookie jar. I'm going to double down and make it clear that it's okay to have your hand in the cookie jar. I'm going to do it publicly. And, you know, one of the things that he is doing is what he always does so well, which is to muddy the waters. Mm-hmm. He's tarring Biden, of course, but he muddy the waters, turn it into a partisan food fight, depict it as nothing more than that. You know, we'll see what happens. I mean, it's deadly serious. What he did was outrageous, but you can see what his strategy is.
Well, I think he's latched onto one truth, which is kind of a hack of the system because we've never had a Trump before. We've had, you know, some weird presidents, but this is a new world. He knows as president of the United States, whatever he says will be repeated endlessly, unfiltered by the media. So he can get up and say the moon is made of green cheese, and the next news cycle will be that soundbite times 1,000 times, and then people reacting to that, debating if the moon is made of green cheese. And by the end of it, a third of the country will think it's green cheese. He knows it. He just has to go out and throw something out every day, and it'll get a free ride. And the only person who can get away with that in American politics is the president.
Yeah. So we're gonna see a lot of that. This morning, Gordon Sondland, the ambassador to the EU,
donor,
who is apparently a middleman. Yeah, big donor, very wealthy Trump donor. And apparently a middleman in all of these discussions, running side saddle with Rudy on trying to get the Ukrainians to start this investigation. He had a bunch of emails that caused everyone's eyebrows to arch. He was an hour away from testifying when they pulled the plug and the State Department said he couldn't. And the president said, we're not going to submit him to a kangaroo court. So it really sounds like they're just going to. We're into full resistance here.
Yeah, they're going to dig in, make some look guiltier. And frankly, now whistleblower number two and maybe three and four and the call transcript and what the president's saying himself about China, there's no mystery here to unravel. He did it. He abused his office. And you can see the numbers start to move. There's some new polling out that's starting to resonate out there in the real world where normally, as you know, these Washington food fights don't really move numbers. But this one is so big and so clear, starring Trump in the center, is starting to clearly have an impact, even among Republicans.
Yeah, the more Washington Post poll said 58%. Very much a partisan split, 8 in 10 Democrats, 4 impeachment, the impeachment inquiry, 8 in 10 Republicans opposed to it. What's interesting is independents were, you know, as is often in American politics, they mirror the overall number. They were at 57%, which should be worrisome to him. The Republicans floated their own poll that said that in
the exact opposite
key battleground districts, you know, yeah, the exact opposite. I think the purpose of that was to try and intimidate some of these Democrats in these districts that Trump won, some of whom have not stepped forward on the impeachment inquiry. A lot of them have to say, hey, there's danger in this for them.
Yeah, there's a little backspin. The Republican poll was of a bunch of congressional districts where either Trump won closely or Trump had the Democrats had picked up a district that voted for Trump. So it was a selective. It has a little English on it. But I think one thing people should keep an eye on, in past polling I've seen, Trump gets his 85%, 90% approval rating. You know, that's root for the Yankees, our team versus them. But when you ask those same Republicans, would you rather have another Republican president or something that doesn't look like you have to say you're for the Democrats, 30 to 40% fall off Trump. So you're seeing the 20 to 30% in the post poll, which admittedly started with adults. I never like adult polls. I like voter polls, and they reduce it. They ask people, are you a revolter voter? But you still see that 20 to 30% of Republicans that are kind of Trump agnostic. And I think that number is going to grow. It'll never get to 50%, but it can get to 30, 35.
I know.
And
this is your.
That'll start. I'm going back to my music, and I know you hate this song.
This is your dream, man. But I know it's your dream. And if it comes true, I will give you all the credit
in the world.
That's
why I'm laying down
But I look at you, I tell this story every time, and I see, isn't this cute?
Yeah, you tell me I'm crazy, and
isn't
I tell
cute?
You
he
this
thinks
story.
That this is all going to work
I
out.
Know, but you're in Democrat land where Republicans all have Simon Legree mustaches.
No, I'm just watching what I see. What I see are Republicans falling in line again and again. And again, so I have no reason to believe.
Well,
and, you know, I see a president with an 87% approval rating among Republicans, which is why they fall in line, and they don't want to get on the wrong side.
Right. No, that I get
that. Tweets.
But if the Republican number, the anti-Trump Republican number, gets to the high 30s, I think it could change some calculations in the Senate. That's all I'm saying. We'll see if it happens. In the post poll, it's at 20 now, and investigations at 30. That's a third, almost a third of Republicans saying go investigate them. That is a movement, and there's some ground for that. That's all I'm saying. A little crack in the big dam.
Okay, you cling to that. We are.
Wait and see.
We have our buddy on the line,
live from Iowa, where the real caucus voters are. Who we got, David?
John Heilman. You know, we could actually take up about half the podcast just on your titles, executive producer of The Circus on Showtime, national affairs analyst at MSNBC, of course, noted columnist and author, and now editor-in-chief of The Recount, which is a cool thing, which we'll talk about at the end, that I recommend to everyone. So where the hell are you?
I'm in Des Moines, Iowa, a place where David Axelrod has had some great triumphs and Mike Murphy has had a lot of failures.
Love Iowa.
There's always candidates here. Once you get to the fall, there's always at least a candidate, if not multiple candidates here on the ground on any given day. It's like this time of the cycle is incredibly exhilarating to me. It's almost as exhilarating as it will be a year from now. But it's great to be here. It's fantastic.
Yeah, I agree with you. So you are it sounds like you fall on the side of, I like the Iowa caucuses as opposed to what the rest of the country or much of the rest of the country other than Iowans say, which is how come they get to have so much say?
Well, it's a perfectly good question. And, you know, I think that I've always thought that it would be, I like the idea of the early states that are small, that allow candidates who don't have a lot of money to get voter contact and to break out. I think the idea of like starting with a national primary or the big states would be a huge mistake. I do wonder in an ideal world, like if we could all play God, whether it would make more sense to have the first four states rotate so that, you know, you would have the Iowa, New Hampshire, South Carolina, Nevada would like take turns going first because they all have different profiles that we understand. And it would be great some year to have a largely African-American electorate like there is in South Carolina on the Democratic side to have them go first. I can imagine that might be a better.
But I don't even think God would tamper with the Iowa people and the Secretary of State in New Hampshire.
Well, luckily you've got God on the podcast, so let me speak up.
Iowa
thing
have a God-like
is great
voice.
Because the Iowans are great, but caucuses, particularly on the Republican side, the Iowa caucus years ago was a little more of a microcosm of a wider Midwestern Republican Party. It has narrowed a bit. It's heavily dominated by the Christian right. It's not a typical Republican primary anymore. So, you know, it may not be the bellwether that it used to be, but it's a system we have and it's not going to change. And it does test your ability to get the Republican base excited and your ability to organize because it's a caucus.
Brother, I got news for you. Your party is dominated by Christian right.
No shit.
But if you look at Republican primaries, a vineyard I've worked in, the Iowa caucus is still a different thing than most of them.
Yeah,
it's in its own world.
I want to say one thing. I'm a huge fan of this podcast and a huge fan of its co-hosts. And I always understood the Hacks on Tap thing to mean like political hacks. And I believe, since I've listened to every episode, I believe I am the first journalistic hack to be on the program. Is that right?
Well, that's mostly true, depending on how you characterize your running mate, Mark McKinnon.
Oh, okay. That's right.
Because
Mark McKinnon was on.
He was on here.
But I'm not even the first host that I'm here.
Much like myself, Mark is a hybrid.
Yeah.
You're a hatless hack. Yeah. First hackless journalistic hack. So you get a trophy for that one. That is a ceiling breaker there.
We're delighted to have you. So let's talk. There's a lot of shit going on right now. Okay. And we're trying to figure out the politics of this impeachment issue and the cross currents now of Turkey, And then the third piece is just, you know, Trump obviously wanted to kneecap Biden with all of this. What impact is, do you think, you're out there in the field, what impact is any of this having on the Democratic race?
Well, I think the place to start, I think, is that, for at least from what I can tell at the moment, that it's obviously the case that the impeachment thing is sucking up a lot of the media oxygen that exists in the coverage of politics. And so therefore, you know, it's been my stipulation, and so far I believe it's true, and candidates seem to think this. I mean, we're right now doing this circus episode for this week where we're spending time. I'm with Cory Booker right now, but we're also spending time with some other candidates who are non-top tier candidates, and they all recognize how in a race that was stable for 8 months, where the top tier was the top tier and everybody in the single digits stayed in the single digits, that the fear is that this impeachment story is going to freeze the race solid and that it's going to be impossible for a non-top tier candidate to get any oxygen in this environment. And so far, it's a little early to say that that's in fact the case, but you can see it in the eyes of a lot of these candidates, you know, the Cory Bookers of the world, the Amy Klobuchars of the world, even the Pete Buttigiegs in the world who have a lot of money. Buttigieg, obviously the rare candidate who has not great polling performance, but has dough. They all are looking around going, how do I get noticed in a world that everybody's focused on Donald Trump, and the only Democrat who gets any airplay in this moment is Joe Biden. So there's a little bit of a desperate times and desperate measures quality to it out here, I think. I don't think voters are super fixated yet on the impeachment thing, even though the media is.
Right. Well, that's a good jumping off point to Biden. I mean, last week down in Austin with the Rover, we talked a lot about Biden has an opportunity here to kind of start the general election, engage Trump and crowd everybody else out because the scandal's about him and he's right. The, at least early, in my view, very vulnerable front runner. And they've kind of, after a long delay I couldn't figure out, they're kind of trying to do it. What kind of points would you give them for execution? And are you feeling any of that in Iowa, kind of line up behind Biden for the epic battle? My gut is they're not doing it well, but at least it's a strategy.
Right. I was with Biden in Reno when he did that, the speech that was supposed to be the moment when they finally said, okay, we're going to take Trump on. And I thought that that speech was fine, but it only got halfway there, right? Because though he stood up and said, I'm not going to let you destroy my family and I'm not going to let you take me on and I'm going to get right in the middle of this fight with you, Donald Trump, and I'm going to make it about you and me. And this is going to be Trump versus Biden. Here's a preview of the general election. The reality is that he did that. And he's going to keep trying to do that. But the problem is that when he does that, and we all know, you guys talked about it on the pod, that the risk entailed there is that if you run into the teeth of this story, it means that that Hunter Biden continues to be a question you're going to have to answer. And they seem to think right now, and Joe Biden in particular himself seems to think that he can run into the teeth of this story, but just say, I am not going to answer questions about my son. And I just, in my history.
He seems so uncomfortable.
He got pissed the other day when someone pressed him on it.
Right. Up in California, he got questioned about it 2 days after that Reno speech. He got questioned about it in California at some SEIU thing, and he kind of lost his shit. And I just think, like, David, I ask you guys, you guys have between the three of us, we've seen a lot of presidential campaigns. Like, a story like whatever, we all would agree that we don't think Hunter Biden did anything illegal, and we know that Joe Biden didn't do anything either improper or illegal. But I think that we all would say that the idea that the sitting vice president's son was on the board of a crooked Ukrainian gas company to the tune of $50,000 a month for 3 years and now has this China element to this, too. It just looks shitty. It's skeezy. It's bad. Right. It's bad swamp behavior. And you're not going to be able to not answer questions about it. You're not.
You're not going to be able to not answer questions about it, whether you run into the fires or not, because this is now a meme in right-wing media.
Right.
It is a constant refrain of the president's. And either you defeat it by running headlong into the fires, or you don't. But, you know, I think one of the things that I've noticed about the Biden campaign is that they seem to be on a 2 week delay.
Right.
Every time something bad happens, it takes them about 2 weeks to land on their strategy.
Well,
I don't know why.
It takes a lot of time to press a vinyl record, David. You got to give them, you know, that doesn't come quickly.
I thought when this first happened that this could be an opportunity for Biden. I do think the Hunter thing is a liability. It would be a liability in any case. But he wanted to paint this as a race between him and Trump.
Yes.
This was an opportunity to do it. And it really was a certification from – it is a certification from Trump that Joe Biden is the candidate he fears.
Yes.
I mean, you can't read it any other way. And there's a reason that he fears him. And Biden could have seized that and just been a constant refrain on this. And he really has been sort of tepid, I think.
Well, yeah, rule one, though, I totally agree. And we've been pitching this. It's an opportunity for Biden to organize the whole thing. But, you know, when you have the meeting, okay, we're going to grab it by the horns, take over the race, squeeze out everybody else. Hello, Mr. President. Step one, we got to be great at the Hunter Biden answer. You know, we gotta grab
Let me say this. If they did not anticipate this, they should just pack up, close up the headquarters and go home.
Right.
This was so obvious.
Yeah.
This was so clearly coming.
Right.
And the fact that they shouldn't have to have a meeting as to how to deal with it.
Right.
They should know what their answer is, and he should be able to give it.
But he can't. That's the thing.
Let me interject just briefly. You guys are
go ahead, John.
You guys are now doing the pod without me again. Here's the thing: that one of the brilliances. Donald Trump is not a political savant, and he's not a political guru, and he doesn't have any magic dust. But the reality is, one thing he does know how to do is to home in on the psychic soft tissue of opponents.
Incredible.
And he knew from the very beginning that Joe Biden's family, because he advertises it, that Joe Biden's family is where the psychic soft tissue is with Joe Biden. And so you're right, David. It was obvious that he was going to go after him from long before this race started. It was obvious that Donald Trump and his minions were going to go after Hunter Biden and make them an issue. And I would say, on the basis of my reporting and my understanding of the vice president, former vice president, that the fact of the Hunter story and his concern about it was a non-trivial reason why he didn't run in 2016. Everybody focuses on the Beau Biden element, the nearness to the tragedy.
Yeah.
That was certainly a part of Joe Biden's emotional cast at that point. But another part, when he thought about what was going to happen to him if he ran in 2016, was he knew that the tabloid stories about Hunter Biden, not necessarily the Ukraine thing, but other things related to substance abuse and marital abuse.
Well, the New Yorker story on him a couple of weeks ago was really sad.
So he knew in 2016 that this was going to be an issue, and I think it factored into his decision not to run. And he could not have not known. He could not have not known because it was a factor in 2016. He must have known it was going to come, given Donald Trump, given the facts and evidence. And so the idea that they did not come into this with an absolute battle plan about how to address this. It came maybe sooner than they thought it was going to come. It came wrapped in this impeachment package that they didn't anticipate, but they should have been ready for this. And I, again, you guys have run a lot of campaigns. I've covered a fair number. I just don't see how a front runner, one of the two front runners in the Democratic field, a former vice president of the United States, with this issue out there, public, known, and the president engaging on it, I don't see, you can't just say, I'm not going to talk about that. It just doesn't seem tenable.
Not at all. Not at all. I think the big tell for me is we now know who the Biden campaign manager is, and it's Biden.
Which has been the case in every race he's ever run.
Killing him.
And I think the question is, you know, again, I agreed with you guys, David. I agreed with you when you said the thing last week. That was actually kind of brilliant. I don't mean to blow smoke up your rear end, but like the analogy.
No, go ahead.
Yeah, more.
the analogy between Nixon and Trump with respect to Nixon and the roots of Watergate and trying to kill that Watergate was all about killing Muskie in order to get McGovern, and that this is an exact replay of that where Trump wants to use dirty tricks to kill Biden in order to get to Warren. That's 100% right. And I do agree that a well thought through strategy of embracing this story but dealing with the Hunter thing could have allowed Biden to recapture the momentum that he had started to lose prior to the story with the rise of Elizabeth Warren. It could have allowed him to really surf this thing, but they've been so unsteady about it, and as you guys said, on they're running slow in their reactions and they're only doing half the job. So I just, that New York Times story the other day captured, I think, there's a lot of internal angst in the campaign about this. There's a lot of internal angst on the candidate's part. And that in this moment, in this testing moment, this is like one of those moments that you get in a campaign where you're tested by the news cycle. And in this case, by the news cycle on a historic level, dealing with impeachment and Donald Trump and everything else. This is the moment where either you're going to rise to this moment and crush it or you're going to crumble.
you know, he has to have an answer for, well, do you think it was appropriate for your son to? And I, you know, and I think, I mean, I'm just conjecturing here, but I think the God's honest truth is that he has a hard time saying no. You know, he's so emotional about his kids.
Yeah.
And I don't think Joe Biden did one thing to help Hunter Biden, but I also don't think he told Hunter Biden no.
Right.
And he, you know, he needs to kind of look, you know, my whole thing is always start from the truth and then work from there, you know. And if that doesn't work, then you, I really think he needs to authentically deal with this. And the fact is people know how he feels about his kids. You know, so a little authentic truth telling from the beginning and then pivoting to Trump, who, by the way, isn't exactly in a position lecture other people on their kids trading on their name around the world.
Of course, David,
would have been good.
David, I'd like you to finish that sentence where you said, start with the truth, and if that doesn't work, and then you trailed off. So what the?
Yeah, well, you know, for time's sake, I can't do that.
To one thing, though, in the Biden is not alone in the how to completely blow, how to handle something follies. You guys ever tried to hide a heart attack before? That was the other epic fail, I think, of the week in politics. We feel bad for Bernie. Happy he's recovering quickly. Yeah. But generally, when you're in the presidential spotlight and you're pushing 80 and you have clearly a cardiac event, you're in the hospital for a couple of days, don't hide it and wait for it to come out. Where do we think Bernie is in Iowa now after all this, John?
Before you answer that, let me say great segue by Mike Murphy there. Go ahead.
I was just
circus. 8 o'clock on Showtime.
I'll say two things. One is just to close off the Biden thing, which is, you know, you've got this now, this candidate debate coming up in Ohio next Tuesday. And, you know, does anybody here not imagine that a legitimate question is going to be asked to other Democratic candidates on that stage? Would they allow one of their children to serve on the board of a foreign company while they're in office if they're president?
Yep.
That is going to be a question that's going to come up. The New York Times is a co-sponsor of this debate, and there are going to be some tough questions, I think, related to Hunter Biden and to the other candidates, putting them in a legitimate way. What's your policy going to be related to your kids? Because
it's coming right over the plate, and we'll see for the fifth time if he can finally hit the ball.
And the Trump precedent is there, too, as David points out. So you've got two different pegs for asking that question, the way that Trump has treated his children and this question. And you can't imagine that the Biden people are not preparing like hell to answer that question, but if they're not, they're engaging in some political malpractice. Now to the Bernie thing, you know,
whether he can deliver the answer is going to be another question,
a whole other question. And then the Bernie thing, you know, look, I think the reality with him is, you know, you think back to what happened with Hillary Clinton had a health episode in the middle of the 2016 campaign. Think about how that was.
9/11 in 2016.
Correct, when she collapsed. And think about what happened when they hid her, when they didn't answer questions for 24 hours, all the things that happened of how the Clinton people, and now if you talk to the Clinton people about that, they will acknowledge it was one of the biggest mistakes they ever made, because the reality is that it allowed for the conspiracy theories that became part of the fake news Russian effort around she has Parkinson's, she has MS, she had a heart attack, all that stuff. That stuff spiked on social media in the last week of the general election. In battleground states, in important congressional districts, social media was flooded with pictures of Hillary collapsing on 9/11. And the fact that they didn't answer it and address it in a clear, clean, transparent way, I think was as damaging to them as almost anything that happened. And that was a purely self-inflicted wound. That had nothing to do. The Russians capitalized on it, but they handled it terribly.
Right.
So that brings you forward to Sanders. Are you guys not learning a lesson here that when it comes to a candidate's health, particularly a candidate who's 78 years old, there's only one way to handle those things, which is with full transparency, full openness. Don't tell them. You got to tell them what hospital they're in. Get the doctor out in front. Get a statement from the doctor. Be open up front about it from the very beginning, because if you're not, the press goes, these fuckers lie to us. And they don't tell us.
Yeah, but you know what? You know what, John? I obviously agree that they should have been more forthcoming on this. But I said back in 2016 that the Clinton people got it wrong, that her vulnerability was stealth, not health. In Bernie's case, he's not seen as someone who's not transparent, even though he hasn't been particularly transparent on things like his personal finances. But he is seen. But the concern is he's 78 years old.
Yeah.
And I think they know that's a concern. And that's what motivated. But I don't think he's going to – people are not going – voters are not going to say – I don't think they're going to say, I can't be for him anymore because he wasn't straightforward about his heart attack. I think they're more likely to say, damn, he's old.
So let me be
clear. I think that's how it resonates. The other thing is it's the same tell as Biden. Who's running Bernie's campaign? It's Bernie. And when the candidate is the campaign manager that way, all the candidates take some faults and take over the strategy. So I'm sure it happened. They were worried. Well, we got to wait for Bernie to tell us what to do. Well, don't tell anybody anything. You know, the cult around the candidate.
I bet his wife Jane stumbled was involved
down this
in that as
probably.
Well.
And they stumbled down this road. And now his campaign theme, I think, is going to be old, 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 old. And it's going to be very hard to get out of that. Maybe it'll spread to the others, too. There will be health questions.
Yeah, Biden could be
as well.
Collateral damage in that.
I agree with you guys that obviously the first vulnerability here is that it calls attention to the fact that he's 78 years old. We don't know yet what the political or physical, for that matter, ramifications of this are going to be going forward. Those are two big open questions. And I agree with you that's where the political vulnerability is. But just to make my small case for my point earlier, which is you guys understand what the difference is between having a press corps that trusts you and having a press corps that doesn't trust you. And I think that part of the reason why it's not that voters necessarily evaluate the transparency. It's that when the press feels that they've been lied to or that the campaign has played hide the candidate or been, try to conceal relevant facts, it poisons the relationship with your press corps. And that was a big problem with Hillary Clinton. A big problem with her was that the fact that the press instinctively always thought that the Clinton campaign was lying to them, even when it wasn't true. They thought the Clinton campaign was lying to them and concealing stuff. And that thing played right into the media narrative and the reflexive biases of the press to think badly about her. And I just worry not that I don't think it's that anything like that bad with Bernie Sanders right now. But it was a thing that for reporters who are focused on, are we dealing with fair dealers in these campaigns who are telling us the truth? It raised some questions. Because reporters do not like to be lied to or have candidates hidden from them. They do not. That's my experience.
Yeah. So one point I want to make about this, and then I just want you to give us a few words on the recount, which I faithfully watch every night. But on this Bernie thing, as a side note, it's really interesting how little coverage that his hospitalization got at relative to where you would get if people thought you were going to be the nominee.
Yes.
One of the interesting things, if Joe Biden had had a health problem, there would have been a stakeout outside of the hospital.
100%. 100%.
And it would have been big news.
It shows how they devaluated his campaign. That's a good point.
And just to say the last quick thing is that to Murphy's original question, in Iowa right now, I think, there's no doubt Elizabeth Warren has the best campaign, the best organization. She is right now, if you had to bet who's going to win the Iowa caucuses today, it would be her. I think that, Sanders has a very nice organization here and a really hard floor. The other person, the person I'm spending time with while I'm here, the person who everybody thinks has maybe the second best or certainly in the top three organizations here is Cory Booker. And he's, I think, someone, the dogs have not been eating the dog food on Cory Booker this year, but if there's someone who you could imagine getting hot at the end out of nowhere and who has the investment and the organization to do it in Iowa, like a genuine come out of nowhere, surprise everyone candidate, it could be him. And I just pay attention to that, I think, as we get closer. David, organize, organize, organize.
Yeah, organize, 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 and get hot at the end. That's Paul Tuz's dictum.
Who tipped you off to that, huh? Who's been ridiculed all year for saying Cory may catch on, and when he won't, I'll be ridiculed some more?
Yeah.
You're giving me nothing.
This is all recorded,
Yeah.
Anyway, Heilman, talk about the recount.
We are building a new platform. It will be an app and a website that is going to be a platform for short-form video, news, analysis, commentary on politics. Just like covering that, our view is that, politics has become is as big a category now as sports, and we like to think of it like sports with consequences. It's like the church of politics is now really broad, and everyone's watching, and so we're trying to make a thing related that make content for and a platform to put it on that is no bullshit, that's efficient and fast and gets you the information that you need in a quick package so you don't have to spend hours and hours of watching cable news, blah, blah, blah. We're making a daily product every day called the Daily Recount that's like a mashup supercut of coverage of the day so that in less than 5 minutes you can watch this thing every night and be like, okay, I kind of know what happened today. www.therecount.com. You can go there now and sign up for the beta that currently exists. You would sign up, you would get an email every night that would send you the Daily Recount every night and the products that we're making every day. But as of about a week or 10 days from now, we're going to be wide open to the public. There won't be, you won't be getting an email. You'll just be able to go to the app or to the site and wallow around in clever, smart, funny, fun.
And let me say, just because I'm not associated with, I think Murphy may be on your board.
I'm deep into the scam.
It is a great, it's a great entertaining product. I look forward to it every day, and I highly recommend it to everyone. John Heilman, back to the hustings with you. Thanks for taking some time with us. Always good to talk to you. I'll see you in Ohio.
Thank you for
good
having
to chat, Johnny.
Bye, guys.
So, Murphy, I think you know that David Plouffe and I were partners for 10 years in business and politics.
I've heard that troubling rumor.
Yes, we did a lot of great stuff together. And he was, in my view, the greatest campaign manager of his generation, of our generation, when he managed the Barack Obama campaign in 2008. Knows the mechanics of campaigns better than anyone I know. And now, I think maybe inspired by us, he started a new podcast called Campaign HQ with David Plouffe. And he's talking to operatives from all of the presidential campaigns. The first two episodes of Campaign HQ, which is available now on Apple Podcasts, radio.com, or wherever you get your shows, features Joe Biden's campaign manager and Elizabeth Warren's chief digital strategist. Every week, David will speak with the key people in the key races that will decide the nomination. And then from there, the road to the White House. So subscribe for free now to Campaign HQ with my buddy David Plouffe. New episodes every Thursday.
I'm signing up. All right, X, it's now the time that America tunes in for the all-important mailbag. Now, if you have a question out there, please send it to us at hacksontap@gmail.com. That is hacksontap.
You don't actually tune into a podcast, do you? But I'm still excited about the mailbag.
I'm reaching out to the Biden
You don't actually
voters.
Send mail either. You know, but anyway, go ahead.
Joe's listening on 8-track right now. And it's hacksontap@gmail.com.
That joke never gets old.
Yeah,
go ahead.
I can't resist. And then he's going to go to a talkie. But anyway, let's go to question number one, which this is for David from Robert, loyal listener Robert. Now, this is a good one. David, would you be willing to trade Obama's second term for never having had President Trump? In other words, if Romney had won in 2012, which I was hoping for, presumably Trump isn't even a serious candidate, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. So would you do the deal?
This is like damn Yankees. I don't know. Listen, here's what I would do. I would not do that deal. I was very happy, obviously, with President Obama and his second term. Was important, but what I would do is I would have gotten a better Democratic campaign and maybe a better Democratic candidate, with all due respect to Secretary Clinton. That was a exercise in malpractice, and even with all the obstacles that were thrown in her way, she should have won that race. So I don't think the problem was the Obama second term, which isn't really what he's saying. I think that you could have had Obama's second term and a Democratic president following Obama had the campaign been better.
Yeah, no, I think it's a fun question, and Robert has a follow-up. If Napoleon had had nuclear subs, would we all be speaking French? I mean, this is a question, and I love the devilish cleverness of it, to see just how much you hate Trump. Would you give up Obama's second term and is a good Obama Democrat? You cannot make that deal, and you're right. Hillary should have won.
Well, you know, the other question would be, is if she did win, what would the Congress look like right now, and would there be a Democratic House right now? But anyway, we could go on endlessly with this. So Jim wants to know, is Trump losing Fox? Is Fox signaling a shift away from full-on, no-questions-asked support for Trump? I see Paul Ryan has been added to the board of directors. I also believe he's responsible for the nomination of new additional directors. Ryan's certainly no Trump fan. And, you know, there is this division between Shepard Smith and some of the actual news people there, Chris Wallace, and the nighttime Amen Corner for Trump. What do you think's going on over there?
Well, I think there is a schism, exactly as you describe it. And I think the most important thing is Trump thinks he's losing Fox, which is driving Trump crazy, which leads to weaker Trump political behavior, which then compounds. I know it's a fact, and one of the great stories Republican operatives told during the campaign is the epic screaming match on the phone between Paul Ryan and Donald Trump during the campaign, during that whole kerfuffle about would they both appear at a rally in Wisconsin. So there's no love lost there. It's been leaked. I believe it's true that Paul Ryan, now on the board, has said, and Fox told Lachlan Murdoch, actually, I think it was the other Murdoch. I can't remember which Murdoch. No, James is out, Lachlan's in. Anyway, told the current chief Murdoch to distance himself from Trump. So there's trouble, but yeah. I think radio-free Trump at night, Hannity, is never going to change.
That's advice that Ryan should have given himself,
I will agree.
Public office.
Now, let's go on to Brad, a question. We'll start with you, Ax. If Democrats vote to impeach Trump and the Senate acquits him, highly likely in the House, how do you think this will impact the race for control of both the House and control of the Senate? That's a great question.
Yeah, well, I think that, you know, the people who are going to feel some impact, if there's an impact, are going to be people in swing districts and swing states. And, you know, I'm not as convinced as others that there is going to be some sort of negative effect on Democrats in these swing districts. They're pretty strong candidates. They're handling themselves well. I think in the Senate race, if the Senate acquits, it puts some of these senators, Susan Collins, Cory Gardner, Martha McSally in Arizona, in a really tough spot. And it wouldn't shock me if Mitch McConnell told them to take a walk on this just so that they don't court problems with independent voters in their states who may decide this election, whether, you know, how Trump feels about that and whether that, you know, buys them primary opposition in the states where filing is still open. I don't know, but that's what I expect will happen.
Yeah, I don't buy the CW security blanket that you hear in Republican circles about, oh, this is going to backfire on the Democrats. There's no reservoir of goodwill for Trump.
Might have been true if they acted on the Mueller report,
even
though I think there was plenty there. But that one has been sold as inadequate, I think, in the minds of voters. I think this is a new set of circumstances.
I'm in the same place. This thing stars Trump. Trump's in the middle of it. And there, again, as I was saying, there's no reservoir of goodwill. It's not like a suburban Republican or independent college-educated woman in the suburbs who voted Democrat in the last midterms flipping a seat. It's now like, oh, I'm so offended that Trump is being, you know, taken off. So I believe, if anything, if the Republicans have a party line vote and only a couple in the Senate defect, Democratic rage will increase, and that'll be very good for their turnout dynamics. Well, Trump will continue to get backed into kind of his cul-de-sac of Republican primary voters and nothing else. So I think politically, impeachment, if the Senate really stonewalls it, will help in both the House and the Senate to the Democrats. And as you said, those three or four, maybe even Tillis and North Carolina, but definitely Arizona, Maine, and Colorado, Cory Gardner,
they're all
in trouble to begin with. And being forced into a yay-nay vote on Donald Trump and his fitness for office in the Senate, which what impeachment really does, is going to be a huge problem for them and maybe even others.
And now it's time for...
Last call.
So here's what's on my mind. You know, you do get a feeling that below the surface, as this Democratic race is going on and all of the attention on impeachment and some of these other issues, Donald Trump is stockpiling a lot of money. He's got a campaign over there that is working the digital circuit very hard, targeting voters. He's got the biggest megaphone, and he knows how to sell these stories, such as the Biden story. And you wonder if the Democrat candidate is going to start in a deficit in terms of the sophistication of the operation that Trump is building over there in the bunker beyond everybody's view. That's my last call, and it's a warning sign, a warning to Democrats that they better take that seriously, the challenge of building a war room that is up to the task.
Okay, my last call starts with an editorial quickly about your last call. You think I'm smoking crack about the Republicans having a bit of a revolt against Trump. Where I think you might be on the pipe is this Trump digital thing. Now, I agree with your pitch. They ought to have a great digital program, and it's all important. But most of the Trump digital stuff is aimed at that same cul-de-sac. That's why he's raising so much low-dollar money. It's click to send $5 to stop Al-Qaeda from, you know, advancing their horrible candidate, fill in Democratic name. So I don't think it's that technically sophisticated, but you're right. It's well-funded, and it's very toxic, and it spreads a lot of BS that could hurt.
Yeah, and could hold his base.
Yeah, no, I think he's really got his challenge. Base. That's his problem. He doesn't have anything
else. But I think there is a potential for leeching from his base, particularly among women, that is something that he has to pay attention to, and he has to disqualify the Democratic nominee. Anyway,
yeah, you're right about that. It's going to be acid in the face 24/7. A lot of it on digital, which is hard to track and can be effective. Quickly, the end of my last call is very simple. There is honor in resigning. It's time for people of seriousness in the bureaucracy. You don't have to be a brave whistleblower, but you can resign. I'm talking to you, senior military people. You know how bad this guy is. You complain about him all the time privately, just like I think Republican senators ought to step up. Nobody's asking them to land on Anzio Beach just to do the right thing on Trump instead of just have a lifetime of inexpensive haircuts at the Senate barbershop. But other senior people in government, it's time to walk and make your statement about a president who's unfit. So step up, I say, step up.
All right, brother.
That wraps us, I think.
I'm always up for a cheap haircut. But anyway, yeah, that's the end of it.
Well, if we had hair, we'd probably be swayed by that argument, too. The Senate barbershop is pretty cool.
Since we don't have hair, we could resign without risking anything. Next week is debate week, and we'll be back together again to mull over what the implications of that are.
And the FEC final info will be in, including cash on hand. I'm dying to see it. All right, pal.
All right, brother. See you next week.